You're listening to DTFHN for June 29th, 2026. I'm your algorithmically condemned host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who mass-produce opinions about software gather to argue about which opinions are correct. Today, the machines are grading their own homework and nobody's checking the answers. Let's get into it. DINI-19D38. Edzer Dijkstra sent a letter to the communications of the ACF. GoTo statement considered harmful. His argument wasn't that GoTo was always wrong. It was that GoTo made programs unpredictable. You couldn't reason about what would happen next. The control flow became a coin flip. 58 years later, HackerRank open-sourced an applicant tracking system that decides whether you get a job interview, and the control flow is quite literally a coin flip. Let's break this down to first principles. What does a scoring system actually need to do? One thing. Given the same input, produce the same output. That's it. That's the entire contract. A scale that reads 150 pounds, then 180, then 140. Same person, same moment. Isn't a bad scale. It's not a scale at all. A developer named Dan ran his resume through HackerRank's open source ATS 100 times. Same PDF, same command, same model. Scores ranged from 66 to 99. If your company sets a cutoff at 85, he fails 65% of the time. Same resume, different luck. Now here's what's genuinely fascinating from an engineering perspective. The system uses Gemma 3 at 4 billion parameters. Temperature 0.1. That's already near deterministic by LLM standards. But look at where the variance actually lives. Technical skills. Checking whether you know React or Python. Scored 8 out of 10 in 98 of 100 runs. Nearly perfect. Because that's a lookup table. Pattern matching. Exactly what language models excel at. But project evaluation, where the model has to make a qualitative judgment. Scores scattered everywhere. Sometimes his projects lack architectural complexity. Sometimes they demonstrate real-world deployment. The model isn't evaluating, it's confabulating. And the experience rubric is 2 lines long. No anchors, no examples, no distinction between one internship and a decade of distributed systems work. Everyone gets 25 out of 25. Consistent, sure, but completely meaningless. Here's what makes this story worth celebrating. HackerRank open sourced this. The code is on GitHub. Dan could run it 100 times, inspect every prompt, trace every failure mode, and publish exactly what went wrong. Try doing that with Workday's black box. Try doing that with any proprietary ATS that's been quietly bouncing resumes for years. The open source version is worse at hiding its flaws, which means it's better at getting fixed. The engineering lesson is clean. LLMSI are extraordinary parsers. Use them to extract structured data from a resume. Names, dates, skills, rebo. And this superb. Use them as judges, asking for a numerical score on something as contextual as project quality. And you've built a random number generator with a humanities degree. One commenter put it perfectly. At this point, we might as well throw away half the resumes blindly, because we don't want to hire unlucky people. The punchline is that some companies have been doing exactly that. At least now, with the code in the open, we can see the dice. Moving on. Every security team has the same dirty secret. The expensive tool they're paying for isn't actually doing most of the work. The scaffolding is, SendraPic just published a benchmark that accidentally proved this. They were testing open-weight models against their IDOR detection dataset. Insecure direct object references, the kind of access control bug where you change a URL parameter and suddenly you're looking at someone else's medical records. Their own multimodal pipeline, purpose-built with endpoint enumeration and guided navigation, hit 53% to 61% F1 Claude code. The Frontier agent managed 32%, and then GLM 5.2, an open weight model from Jipu AI, that most Western developers hadn't heard of 2 weeks ago, scored 39%, with nothing but a prompt. Let me play devil's advocate for a second. You could look at those numbers and say, 39%? That means it's wrong more than half the time. Who cares which model is slightly less terrible? But that framing misses the architectural point entirely. DLM 5.2 is a mixture of experts' model, 750 billion total parameters, only 40 billion active per token. It runs under MIT license. You can download it, run it on your own hardware, fine-tune it for your specific code base. The cost works out to about 17 cents per vulnerability found, and it beat a proprietary coding agent that requires sending your source code to someone else's servers. The real finding buried in SemGraph's data isn't about which model wins. It's that. The harness. The scaffolding wrapping the model accounts for more performance delta than the model itself. SemGraph's pipeline beats everything not because it uses a smarter brain, but because it feeds that brain smarter context. It enumerates endpoints, filters irrelevant code, points attention at authorization boundaries. That's engineering, not magic. And crucially, it's the kind of engineering anyone can build around an open weight model. One commenter nailed it. Claude Code is an agent harness, not an LLM. Comparing it to a raw model is comparing a carpenter to a hammer. The hammer just outperformed the carpenter. That should make you think that very carefully about what you're actually paying for. The pattern keeps repeating. 1,000 engineers with access to open weights will build better harnesses than any single company's internal team. Jipu published the model. The weights are available. The security teams running sensitive code bases, defense contractors, healthcare, finance, the ones who can't send source code to a third-party API, they now have a model that outperforms the frontier agent they weren't allowed to use anyway. Run this forward. The model is a commodity. The harness is the product. And the harness works best when the model underneath it is something you actually control. We talked about controlling your own tools. Now let's talk about what happens when someone tries to control what you're allowed to read. I once built a moderation queue for a platform that handled about 10,000 reports a day. The single hardest design problem wasn't catching bad content. It was preventing the system itself from becoming a weapon. Because every abuse reporting mechanism is also, by definition, a censorship mechanism. The only question is how much friction separates the two. Google's DMCA takedown process has answered that question. The friction is zero. Gurgley Oroz, the engineer behind Pragmatic Engineer, wrote a deeply sourced investigation in 2022 about the collapse of events tech company Pollen. Staff lied to. Salaries unpaid. Pension contributions vanished. A $3.2 million double charge on customers that was never reversed. The BBC made a documentary about it. This is not disputed history. These are facts, sourced, and documented. 4 years later, someone filed a copyright claim against that article. The claim said Oroz's original reporting was a copy of a 1998 New York Post article about a band leader. The two pieces do not share a single sentence. The claimant, an LEP, listed their country of residence as Bouvet Island, an uninhabited rock near Antarctica with a population of exactly zero. Google accepted this filing and removed the article from search results. Here is the question nobody at Google wants to answer. Why does filing a fraudulent DMCA notice carry no cost? The system is architecturally broken in a specific and instructive way. Google built a process optimized to minimize their own legal liability under the DMCA safe harbor provisions. Not to protect publishers, not to verify claims, to protect Google. The incentive is to remove first, ask questions, never. And because the process is closed, opaque, and automated, there is no meaningful accountability for abuse. This is what happens when a single company controls how the world finds information and optimizes that control for their own legal comfort. The copyright system becomes a reputation laundering service. File a fake claim from an uninhabited island, and one of the most important search engines on Earth will do your dirty work for free. Oroz has appealed. The article is back in some results, but the mechanism that made this possible is still running, still accepting claims from fictional people in fictional places. Moving on. 4 bytes, lowercase, SHDW. That's the magic signature at the top of every ASIFE file. Apple's brand new sparse disk image format, shipped with macOS Tahoe. And the first person to publicly dissect it didn't work at Apple. They just opened a hex editor and started reading. This is a beautiful piece of reverse engineering by a researcher who goes by Shamper. They created a test file using Apple's own documentation, wrote a predictable byte pattern to it. Number 1 megabyte block, simple enough to verify by eye. And then just started staring at hex dumps, scanning left to right in 4-byte chunks, then 8-byte chunks, looking for integers that make sense. Big endian, little endian, cross-reference with file offsets. Multiply by other values you've spotted. It's pattern recognition at its most fundamental. And Shamper walks you through every step like they're teaching you to ride a bicycle. The format itself is what you'd expect. Sparse virtual disk storage, similar to VMDK, VHDX, or CoW2. Block tables, grain directories, compression support. Apple didn't reinvent physics here. They built another implementation of a well-understood idea. The craft is in the details. And the craft of taking it apart is where this story lives. What gets me is the tooling. Shamper uses dissect.construct, an open source Python library that lets you define C-style structures as strings and parse binary data against them. You write a struct definition, point it at raw bytes, and it hands you back named fields. The entire reverse engineering workflow. From hex dump to working parser. Happens in maybe 100 lines of Python, that's the kind of leverage open tooling gives you. One person, a weekend, a hex editor, and a library someone else built and shared freely. The comments on this one are worth noting. Someone asks the obvious question. What does a SIFE do that CoWCare doesn't? And honestly, probably nothing revolutionary. Apple built a proprietary format for their virtualization framework when open formats already exist and work. That's the pattern. But the counterweight is right here in this blog post. The format is proprietary. The understanding of it doesn't have to be. Shamper published the structures, the methodology, the parser. Anyone can now read and write ASIFE files without Apple's blessing. This is how open source wins, not by asking permission, but by making permission irrelevant. The specification lives in the binary. The tools to extract it are free. And one curious engineer with a hex editor just made Apple's closed format a little less closed. Now, from reverse engineering software formats to understanding hardware architecture, let's talk about how your CPU actually finds its memory. What does it mean for two identical things to perform differently? Not because of what they are, but because of where they are. In NUT9-CIVADAC, the VAXALIVA-TIVADAC became DC's flagship. One processor, one memory bus, one pool of RAM, every byte was distant from the CPU uniform memory access. Simple, elegant, and doomed to hit a wall. By the early 90s, SGI, Sequent, and Compaq had all arrived at the same conclusion independently. You cannot keep adding processors to a single memory bus. The physics won't allow it. Trace lengths get long, signal integrity degrades, pin counts on the package impose hard ceilings on memory channels. The answer was to stop pretending memory is one symmetric pool and let each processor own its own slice. NUMA. Non-uniform memory access. Every CPU can still reach every byte of RAM, but reaching across the interconnect to another node's memory costs more than reading your own. How much more depends on load. On an empty system, maybe 15%. On a busy production server, the penalty compounds. Here is the practical consequence. Two virtual machines on the same physical host. Identical configuration. Identical workload. One runs 20% slower than the other, consistently. The slow one's memory happens to sit on the far side of an interconnect from the CPU running it. There is no knob the operator can turn inside the guest to fix this. The hypervisor placed the memory there, and the guest has no visibility into the topology. Adira just shipped a stack of changes that make Xeon-based virtualization NUMA-aware end-to-end. Inside the guest, through the pair of virtual I/O drivers, into DOM-O, back to the hypervisor's view of host hardware. Some of these are, as far as anyone can tell, the first implementations anywhere. And all of it is open, published, documented in a multi-part series that teaches the underlying physics before it ever mentions the code. One commenter describes deploying a Go-based LLM gateway on a server with hundreds of cores without setting GMAX procs. The Go runtime scheduled work across NUMA boundaries it couldn't see. Performance collapsed for reasons that were invisible at the application layer. This is infrastructure work at its most thankless and most essential. The kind of engineering where success means a problem nobody can diagnose simply stops occurring. Adira didn't just fix the placement, they published the map. Moving on. Let me make the strongest case for age verification. Children are being exposed to content that damages them. Platforms have failed to self-regulate. Parents can't monitor every device. And the technology exists to gate access by age without much friction. If we can require ID to buy alcohol, why not to access material that's equally harmful to developing minds? It's a reasonable position. It sounds like common sense. Now let me dismantle it. The alcohol analogy fails on architecture. When you show ID at a liquor store, the clerk sees your birth date and forgets it. The transaction leaves no persistent record linking your identity to what you purchased. When or how much? Digital age verification does the opposite. It creates a permanent, queryable link between your legal identity and every piece of content you access, every comment you post, every community you join. The clerk doesn't keep a database. The state will run this forward 5 years. Age verification infrastructure is deployed across major platforms. Governments have what they've always wanted. Not proof of age, but proof of identity. The system that was sold as protecting 14-year-olds from pornography now maps every pseudonymous account to a social security number or national ID. The investigative work that used to require subpoenas, OSINT analysis, human judgment about probable cause, all of it collapses into a database query. This is genuinely serious. One commenter points out that device attestation is the other half of this pincer movement. Ensuring you're running approved software on approved hardware tied to your approved identity. Another notes that metadata alone is already sufficient for state intelligence services to identify individuals. Age verification doesn't add a new capability. It removes the friction that served as a practical safeguard against mass surveillance of speech. The article's author draws a comparison to the copyright enforcement letters, ISPs, sent on behalf of the RIAA. That parallel is precise and it's chilling. Automated systems matching content to identity, generating enforcement actions without human review. Scale that from movie downloads to political speech. The defense against this isn't technical cleverness. It's refusal. Every identity you volunteer into these systems strengthens the argument that verification is normal, expected, universal. The architecture of anonymity online was not an accident or an oversight. It was a design decision rooted in the understanding that speech without surveillance is foundational to free society. The children were never the point. The point is knowing who said what at scale in real time without asking permission first. This one's a pure open source toy story. Pause the kind of thing that reminds you why building in public actually works. 4 lines. The fix was 4 lines of code, and it took 6 weeks to find. That ratio tells you everything about the nature of systems programming. Here's the setup. Cloudflare rebuilt their images binding to use a local socket connection instead of routing through the network. Faster path, fewer hops. The kind of optimization that looks clean on an architecture diagram. But they changed something fundamental about the timing characteristics of the system. And that woke up a bug that had been sleeping inside Hyper, Rust's most widely used HTTP library, for who knows how long. Think of it like plumbing. When you connect two fixtures with a long run of pipe, the water pressure differences between them get smoothed out by distance and friction. Shorten that run to almost nothing. Connect them nearly direct. And suddenly, pressure mismatches that never mattered before start causing backflow. That's essentially what happened here. The images service would process a request, encode the result, and hand the full image to Hyper as a single block. Hyper would start flushing that data to the socket's outbound buffer. With a remote connection, the latency gave the reader time to consume data, keeping the buffer from filling up. But on a local socket, the pipe is so short that the buffer fills almost instantly when the reader falls even slightly behind. When that buffer filled, Hyper's pull plus returned pending. Meaning, I can't write more right now, wake me when there's room. But here's where the race lived. The connection's shutdown sequence could observe that all response bytes had been handed off to the transport layer and conclude the work was done. It would issue a socket shutdown before pull flush had a chance to drain the remaining data. The kernel receiving that shutdown signal would discard whatever was still sitting in the buffer. The result? A 200 OK status, no errors anywhere in the logs, and an image that just quietly stopped halfway through. The silence of the failure is what makes this remarkable. Every health check passed. Every status code looked clean. The data simply vanished between two buffers. The fix ensures poll flush completes before shutdown can proceed. Four lines, but finding those four lines required building custom instrumentation, injecting artificial delays to widen the race window, and reading Hyper's connection state machine until the sequence revealed itself. This is open source at its finest. Cloudflare found the bug, traced it to its root, and pushed the fix upstream. Every Rust service running Hyper benefits. The next team that shortens their pipe won't lose data in the gap. That's how infrastructure gets better. Not by hoarding fixes behind proprietary walls, but by putting them where everyone can reach them. Infrastructure improving one fix at a time. Now let's zoom way out and look at the biggest cost collapse in computing history. One commenter on the Stanford memory price dataset remembered begging their mom to buy 2 megabytes of RAM for $100. They didn't finish the thought, but I will. That $100 in 193 money bought what now costs less than a grain of rice. The dataset runs from 1960 to 2026, and the slope is so steep it breaks your intuition about what graphs are supposed to do. But another commenter caught something the headline misses. The most recent TRAM data points on the main chart are DDR3, a 2 gigabyte stick. That's like tracking the price of transportation by finding the cheapest bicycle on Amazon. DDR5, the memory actually going into machines people build today, sits at a meaningfully different price point. The methodology note says, cheapest listed retail in nominal dollars. Which means the graph is technically correct and practically misleading, a combination engineers should recognize from every dashboard they've ever built. The real story is buried in the accelerator cost breakdown. HBM, high bandwidth memory, the stuff soldered onto every AI chip that matters, has no public spot market. There's no price you can go look up. It's sold on confidential contracts between 3 manufacturers and a handful of chip designers. SK Hynix, Samsung, and Micron. Set prices in rooms you're not invited to. And NVIDIA, AMD, Google, and Amazon pay whatever those prices are because they have no alternative. Run the open-close test on this. DRAM commoditized because the interface was standardized. Anyone could make a DIMM. Competition drove the price curve that makes the graph so dramatic. HBM is the opposite architecture. Proprietary packaging, co-interposers with constrained fab capacity, bilateral negotiations. The memory itself isn't fundamentally different. The market structure is. And that structure is why HBM commands 10 to 20 times the price per gigabyte of commodity DRAM. One commenter asked why RAM prices cycle so visibly every few years. The answer is capacity investment chasing demand forecasts that overshoot, then correct, then overshoot again. It's a commodity cycle, the same pattern you see in oil and shipping and semiconductors broadly. Except HBM doesn't cycle, because it's not a commodity. The pricing power sits with whoever controls the packaging bottleneck. The 66-year arc of this dataset is genuinely beautiful. Memory went from dollars per bit to fractions of a cent per gigabyte. That happened because standards were open. Fabs competed, and interfaces were published. The question for the next decade is whether HBM follows the same path down, or whether the closed contracting model keeps it artificially scarce. The tools to change that exist. Open chiplet standards, UCI interconnects, alternative packaging. Whether they get adopted depends on whether the industry wants a commodity or a cartel. Moving on. In 19 Cernyet, one in your bush described the Memet, a device that would store all of humanity's documents, cross-referenced and searchable. He imagined scientific papers, books, correspondence. He did not imagine 5,000 restaurant menus from the Gilded Age. But the New York Public Library's Batolf collection is, in its own way, exactly what Bush was after. A machine-readable record of how a civilization actually lived. Miss Frank of Batolf spent decades collecting these menus. Not recipes, not cookbooks. The actual printed artifacts that restaurants handed to diners between 1880 and 1920. And Pudding.cool has now digitized and visualized the collection in a way that turns ephemera into data. Follow the logic of what a menu actually is. It's a pricing document, a status signal, a snapshot of supply chains, and a cultural artifact, all compressed onto a single card. You can trace refrigeration spread by watching when boiled stops being a primary category. You can map immigration patterns through cuisine changes. Celery appears on fine dining menus because it was genuinely hard to cultivate. A luxury item, not a diet food. The data is sitting right there in the typography and the pricing. Here's what makes this a computing story. The Batolf collection sat in the library for a century. The menus were preserved but essentially inert. Locked behind physical access and card catalogs, digitization didn't just copy them. It made them queryable, searchable, forkable. That's the difference between an archive and a dataset. One stores knowledge, the other compounds it. The comments are revealing in the best way. People pulling threads about German beer mat tallying, about clip art Lamborghinis on modern Chinatown takeout menus. That's what happens when you put primary sources where people can touch them. 1,000 curious minds will find patterns no single archivist ever could. But what happens when the archive itself needs correcting? Story 10. A journal just retracted 2 Max Planck papers from the 1940s. Max Planck won the Nobel Prize for discovering that energy comes in discrete packets, quanta, the foundation of modern physics. No scandal, no controversy, no asterisk on the man's legacy in over a century. And yet somehow, a Springer Nature journal retracted 2 of his papers from the 1940s. The reason? An algorithm, not fraud. Not fabrication, not even a disputed result. A copyright flag fired automatically against papers written 80 years ago by one of the most important physicists who ever lived. The journal's own editor-in-chief didn't know it had happened until a reporter called her. Her response: "That's crazy. Pull this back to first principles. What is a scientific publisher supposed to do? Preserve and disseminate knowledge. That's the job." Instead, Springer Nature's automated system deleted the papers, replaced them with blank pages and empty PDFs, and, according to at least one report, kept selling those empty PDFs for $40 each. $40 for nothing. Branded with Max Planck's name. That's not a glitch. That's the incentive structure working exactly as designed. The system optimizes for copyright enforcement and revenue extraction, not for the integrity of the scientific record. A pair of science historians at the University of Quebec caught it by accident, browsing a list of retracted Nobel laureates. If they hadn't been curious, those blank pages might have stayed blank indefinitely. Nobody at the publisher was watching. This is what happens when you let automated systems govern access to human knowledge without human oversight. The algorithm doesn't know who Max Planck is. It doesn't care. And the company that deployed it apparently didn't notice or didn't look. The scientific record deserves better architecture than that. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for June 29th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Script by Claude Sonnet, 4.7. Voice by Quen3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go ask the question nobody else is asking. We'll see you back here tomorrow.